Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing all right, Justin, but really, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, feeling much better. We've gotten a lot of requests to cover the Dylan Redwine case, and if you're not familiar with it, it's a terribly tragic story out of Colorado. Another podcast, True Consequences, is currently doing a deep dive into the story. I think he's two or three episodes into it right now. If you haven't heard or listened to True Consequences, check it out. Eric does a phenomenal job. Again, maybe one day Aaron and I will get around to covering that case, but for now, I highly recommend True Consequences. So with that, tonight's case, Aaron, is another sad one about a mother and father who are brutally murdered. I would say that the perpetrator would be shocking, but you're all listening to this podcast, so I don't think there's much that's shocking anymore. But with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the murders of Dr. Martin Cohen and his wife, Ethel Cohen. This took place in Hockessin, Delaware, November 12th, 1988. And a little background, Dr. Martin Cohen, he was a father of one, Charles Mark Cohen, and he loved his family. He also worked at a hospital as a psychiatrist. This was the Delaware State Hospital, and it was said that he worked hard to make it a better place for patients. His wife, Ethel, originally was a Broadway actress way back when, from Chicago. She also worked as a U.S. Army instrumental mechanic back then, and then later an occupational therapist. And of the two parents, she was the one that you'd say maybe doted on her son more.
Possibly he was a mama's boy, as they call it, but she felt Charles could do no wrong and was very protective of him.
So Martin met his wife when they were working at the Mental Health Institute in Jacksonville, Illinois. So they spent about 25 years in Illinois before they moved to Delaware. Now their son, he liked to play tennis. He attended Galesburg High School. He was considered a very good student, but sometime later in his teens, he started acting up. He became the class clown. And, if you read up on this case, probably the most popular story about him is that he would walk into a fast food joint and fake a seizure. So, of course, people rush over to help him and EMTs are called, but then he would jump up and say, never mind. He graduated in 1982 and enlisted in the Marines, but dropped out after a few weeks. He had been caught with drugs. Now, his dream was to be in a band, and he certainly gave it a go. I mean, he joined a band named Bourbon and Clorox, but I think he didn't quite fit in well with others, and he was probably difficult to work with. But I don't think it's easy for people to be in bands. Would you say, Justin?
No, there's always artistic differences and whatnot. And a band called Bourbon and Clorox, I don't know what their topics or subject matter would be, but I would assume that they wouldn't take themselves that seriously. Yet it said that most of his lyrics were about a strange man following him around with a gun. So a little darker tone compared to the sort of ridiculousness of the name of the band.
He tried dating. I said tried because he did have a relationship with a girl that went on for a short while, but she was afraid of him and she broke up with him. Now, according to people in the know, Charles was kind of depressed and also began having violent and sexual fantasies. And he developed a binge eating disorder and began using drugs again. So one of the drugs that he liked to take was LSD, and apparently he took it many times between 1984 and 1986. So about this time, Ethel is in her 60s, and she's not doing that well. Her health has declined. She had knee problems, arthritis. She had to walk with a cane, and she had high blood pressure. Her husband, Dr. Martin, developed colon cancer.
So this is a rough time for any family when, you know, both your parents are having health issues and you're probably, as a child, maybe not getting the attention you're used to, and you're struggling with, you know, drugs and dropping out of the military. There's a lot going on here. But in 1988, Martin, his father, was offered a job as the director in the Delaware State Hospital. And it's the largest mental health facility in that state. And this is going to put some stress on the family too. And I'm sure that the son, Charles, having to uproot his life and leave all of his friends didn't help much.
So one of the things about this hospital was they had multiple directors in the past few years. And so the great thing about Dr. Martin Cohen was that he promised the staff that he would stay until he actually retired. So they expected him to be there a while. And he was just 58 years old. So that was totally feasible, you know, as long as everything went well with his health, etc. He was there about 7 months. He was helping them with all kinds of issues. I mean, one of their issues was their public reputation. And you can imagine with all these directors going in and out, that probably didn't help things. There's nothing like having a good, capable person riding the ship, right?
And you would think that somebody that works as a doctor and a director at a mental health facility would have a good grasp and knowledge on people that are in need or people that are in having a mental health crisis. But it seems that sometimes you might have your blinders on to the ones closest to you.
Charles enrolled as an art student at the University of Delaware, and what we know about his, I guess you could say, happiness level, having moved from Illinois to Delaware, is based on a letter that he wrote to a friend. And in the letter he wrote, "My father and especially my mother would need my help in Delaware, and so sacrificing my own happiness for them, I moved to Delaware." I don't know about you, Justin, but it certainly sounds like he didn't want to go, but he felt like he had to, and he's not happy about going there.
Yeah. It's an obligation. And because of the, I guess, health issues that his parents are having and probably him not being able to really take care of himself, he's going to go on to Delaware.
So he gets a job working at a gas station and he meets some new friends and he's able to start a new band. This one is John Hinckley's Kids. And I'm sure most people know who that is, but if you don't, John Hinckley was the man who attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan.
What a name of a band.
So November 12th, 1988, this is the day in question, Justin.
It was a regular day for the family as both of his parents were awake that evening. It was around 8 or 9 p.m. They were watching TV downstairs. Now, the way the house is set up, his parents pretty much live downstairs and the upstairs belongs to Charles, their son. Charles will end up calling down to his dad and telling him to come upstairs so he could show him his latest artwork. So Martin goes upstairs and goes in and looks to the artwork. And when his back is turned, Charles takes a 10-pound metal dumbbell and smashes his father in the back of the head. He strikes him repeatedly. Martin will fall down to his knees, but he's still conscious, and he will end up trying to fight Charles off, but Charles is going to continue beating him. Once Martin is pretty much incapacitated, Charles stabs him with a pocket knife just to make sure he was dead.
Yeah, he stabbed his dad all over. He stabbed him in the chest, the neck, the thigh, the back, and the stomach. And they believe that even though he was fairly incapacitated, that he attempted to try and fend off the knife because there were a few defensive wounds on his hands.
Now it's at this point that Charles comes back out to the stairs and calls out for his mother. And he says, "Mom, Dad fell down. Come up and look quick." And so Ethel, who has bad knees and is not in the greatest health, she runs upstairs and she finds her husband laying there. At that point, she's turning around to face Charles right when he's swinging the dumbbell to hit her. And he beats her with that dumbbell. And she tried to defend herself, but she can't do anything to a young guy like Charles with a 10-pound dumbbell. I don't think anyone really could for that matter. But after she fell down, he used the knife to finish her off too. She had taken the portable cordless phone up with her because she was intending to call for help for her husband, but she didn't get a chance. Charles was afraid that he had made so much noise and commotion that he looked out to his neighbors' houses to see if any of them were looking at him or calling the police. And he waited to see if the police were going to show up. And then when he decided everything was safe, he ransacked the house and collected any money and jewelry or valuables that he could find. He made no effort to clean up the crime scene.
Now, he had stolen, what, $500 to $700 from his parents. And his next stop, well, taking one of their cars, was to go buy cocaine. But apparently, he wasn't happy with the amount that he was being offered. So he went with his dealer to Chester, Pennsylvania, so that Charles could acquire more drugs. But what happened when he went to go get more drugs, Justin?
Well, when you show up to your drug dealer with more money than they have drugs and then demand that they find more drugs for you, well, sometimes that drug dealer is going to take advantage. So they rob Charles at gunpoint and take his money.
I'm sure everyone felt bad for him, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that original deal went bad, but Charles really wanted more cocaine. So he ended up driving back to Delaware to drop his drug dealer off, you know, the one that had gone with him. And then he went back to Chester by himself and he met another dealer there who did get him the drugs he wanted. They went to Hokeson and parked behind the post office. So he tells this dealer to wait in the car. And he's saying, you know, I've got two vehicles. I want to sell one of them. And if we can do that, then I'll give you half the money from the sale. So he's planning to sell the family's Nissan and he's going to drive the Ford LTD. So this other drug dealer is driving the Nissan, but he just takes off in it. So now he doesn't have the second car.
So he got robbed twice now. Once when he was trying to buy cocaine and a second time when the other drug dealer took off with his family's car. Got it. Life in the fast lane, right?
Yeah. So he's committed two murders. He's bought drugs and he doesn't really have much to show for all this because, you know, he originally had the $500 to $700, whatever that was, but he didn't get any credit cards or anything like that. So he has very limited funds.
He murdered his parents and all he got was a car and a few $100. That's how much value he placed on his parents' lives.
Well, I think that's just it. I think it was just about murdering them. I don't think he did it for profit. I think that was the afterthought. It was like, let's see what's around. Martin, like I said, had a job, but on Monday, November 14th, he didn't show up for work. And because he had been so reliable, they took this to mean someone should go and check on him. So two of his coworkers decided to head to his home that afternoon. And while they knocked, they even ended up calling the realtor who rented this home to the Cohens. That's who let them in. And that's when Martin and Ethel's bodies were discovered. So the police were brought in, of course. And when they got to the scene, they started looking around. They couldn't find Dr. Martin or Ethel's son, and the family vehicles were both gone. So they didn't know what was happening here. They had no idea.
They're going to keep tabs on Charles because they don't know if he's a victim or a suspect at this point, but everyone has a routine or a schedule they stick to. So they're waiting to see if Charles shows up for his classes the following week. And of course, he doesn't. And after looking through the crime scene, finding that there was no forced entry and that the entire attack happened upstairs in Charles's, you know, by Charles's bedroom or in his bedroom with a dumbbell from within the house that who knows if they had the fingerprints off that dumbbell, but I'm pretty sure they did because at this point, the police put out a bolo for Charles and the Black Ford LTD.
And they knew which car he was in because the Nissan was found November 15th. So that's just a day later. This was all coming together rather quickly. And here's another thing that happened. His parents, there was a funeral in New York and there was a memorial service on November 21st. Charles was not in attendance. So there was a warrant issued for the arrest of Charles Mark Cohen, charging him with two counts of first-degree murder and two counts of possession of a deadly weapon during a felony. So it's from this point on, Justin, when he's on the run.
Yeah, he's conning people out of money, just doing whatever he can to make it, and he'll end up in Los Angeles. Now, anyone that lives in Los Angeles knows that there's three things that you can rely on, and that is death, taxes, and parking tickets or parking violations. And apparently, there was a parade route that he had parked the car on, and it had been towed because they don't mess around out there. They just tow your car. Usually, they boot it, but since it was a Christmas parade, they just towed every single car that was on that road, including his car. But that's not going to slow Charles down. He's going to go to the impound lot and convince the attendant there that he has left something inside of the car that he needs to go get. He's going to get in that car and drive off and try to run over the parking lot or impoundment attendant on his way out the door. So yeah, he is now a con artist and trying to kill people that get in his way.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So by February of 1989, Charles is in rough shape. He's staying at a Salvation Army men's shelter in Sacramento and did some part-time work. But it's during this time where he adopts another name. He starts using the name Michael Richards. And he also starts watching America's Most Wanted.
Of course he does.
This is interesting because he ends up seeing himself profiled on the show. And apparently they described him as a punk rock drummer who killed his parents. But only he thought they were covering him. So he moved on to another city because he was worried that they were coming after him.
So it's February 23rd, 1989. I mean, he's been on the run for a while. He ends up befriending a Wells Fargo banking executive named Conrad Lutz. Now, Lutz is a very successful single gay man, and they hang out. He takes Charles out for dinner and invites him back to his house. It's at that point when Charles decides that he's probably going to kill Conrad, but he is waiting for the right moment, I guess, because the next morning, Conrad Lutz gets up and goes to work. He leaves Charles some money to buy food and tickets to, you know, the movie theater. And Charles is promising him a special night that night when he gets back. But of course, when Lutz gets off work and comes home, they have dinner and they get back to the apartment at around 7:30. Charles is eating ice cream and watching a movie, and he notices all of the nice expensive things that Conrad Lutz owns, you know, TV, stereo system. And so that night when they go to bed, Charles leaves the room, says, "Hey, I need a minute to go freshen up." And instead he goes and grabs a knife, a dagger that he had hid in the living room earlier that day. And he comes back and proceeds to stab Conrad Lutz in the heart. You know, Conrad will try to fight him off, but Charles, you know, he just continues stabbing him over and over, overkill almost.
And just like before, when he had murdered his parents, he doesn't try to manipulate the scene at all. He just cleans himself and he changes his clothes, and then he starts looking for things to take. But while he's looking around and basically looting the place, he hears a knock. And this is because the neighbors thought there was a fight. And so they had called the police. And this was the police asking Charles to come out. And he had an interesting reaction. He basically sat down on the floor and just stayed quiet until they left. He really thought they were going to get him. But since the police never came into the apartment, well, he got away.
Well, if he would have answered the door, they would have been able to claim probable cause or say they could search the place. But he didn't answer the door. So they would probably need a warrant to enter. And they didn't have that. So they ended up leaving.
So he spent a few hours there packing up duffel bags full of stuff. He only ended up finding $15 in cash, but he did steal some jewelry and a watch. Then he called for a taxi and he headed to San Francisco.
And this, he has no value for human life. I mean, he killed his parents and all he got was a few hundred dollars. And this man, Conrad, he could have hung out with him. Conrad would have probably paid for Charles to live for a while, but it wasn't about that. Charles wasn't even gay. He wasn't there for a relationship. He wasn't there for anything. He was simply there as a con to get what he wanted and honestly just murder somebody else.
That was part of the opportunity. Now in San Francisco, he sells most of what he had taken from Lutz's place, except for the gold cufflinks. Now, we had talked before about how he didn't take any credit cards or anything from his parents. Well, from Lutz, he had grabbed some checks and credit cards, but he didn't know the access code to these cards, and no one would take a check from him. Now, it was on February 25th when Conrad Lutz's body was discovered, and you know, once again, the neighbors are concerned. They called the apartment manager saying, you know, we haven't heard from this guy in a while. Normally we would have by now. And the manager did a welfare check. And it was quite obvious to the police when they showed up that robbery was the motive. Well, at least in their minds.
And some of the residents saw what they called an unkempt man, which would be Charles, you know, somebody who's not very well groomed because Conrad was very put together. They say that this unkempt man arrived at 9:30 p.m. on the 24th, and at 11 p.m., they heard an argument and a fight. And that's when, of course, the police were called to the apartment but did not enter. When the police finally got into the apartment, they found Charles's fingerprints and a used condom. Now, they found his fingerprints all over the murder scene. So it's pretty obvious who committed this crime. And again, on February 26th of 1989, America's Most Wanted premiered.
Charles is trying to find a restaurant that's playing the show because he likes watching the show, but it's the episode that covers him. You know, his crime is making headlines. So he starts going all over the country. I mean, he goes to New York, he goes to New England. He's trying to score drugs. And so he would steal from people. He would target people who he thought would be too afraid to report his crimes. And he was using fake identities all along. I guess the source of these names, these aliases that he used, he would read books in libraries to help him figure out which names to use. So in, let's see, the summer of 89 to the early part of 1990, he goes to New York and he starts living under an alias, Jesse Connor. And he almost got busted. A police car showed up and chased him until he hid in the bushes while he was in Central Park. I guess because of his appearance, another person in this park thought he was a killer and threatened to take him to the police. So Charles starts to feel like, this isn't a good place to be anymore.
So he goes down to New Orleans. And it's at this point that the FBI has created a profile for him, talks about how he goes to parks and soup kitchens, sleeps in alleys. They do a whole write-up on him, and they offer a $2,500 reward, which I would expect more, but it's what they have to offer at that time. Now, while he's in New Orleans, he lives in a efficiency apartment, which is essentially a studio apartment. There's no electricity, and it's kind of a rundown area, which allows him to blend in very easily and not stand out to law enforcement or anyone. He has a new friend named Greg Fitch, and they work for an organization that advocates for the rights of homeless people. And let's just say Charles' neighbors, they felt like he was a little off and fake and trying to fit in. No one really got along with him. And Charles and Greg will end up going bar hopping a lot. And they end up at Igor's Lounge and Game Room. And Charles attempted to talk to the bartender. And she remembers this encounter. And she says, "I thought he was a psycho the first time I met him. He was one of those people who thought he could convince you with his good looks." So even when he's an unkept gentleman, he still has his charm and boyish look about him that makes people think he's innocent, but she saw right through it.
On April 2nd, 1990, there was an incident with a cab where Charles hailed a cab and he asked the driver to take him to a certain community. But Charles started to get a real attitude and became angry and started cursing at this cab driver. And when they were at an intersection, he jumped out. So this cab driver chased him and actually helped an elderly woman who almost got carjacked by Charles. But unfortunately, after he ran away, he approached an 80-year-old woman who was in her front yard. And she mistook him for a meter reader. And he grabbed her and forced her back into her house. And she fell down. She became injured. And her daughter saw this happening and came running out of the house. Charles tried to get her car keys. Then the daughter's husband came out and Charles hit him and stomped on him, then ran off. And, you know, this husband gave chase for a couple of blocks, but he lost him. But the cab driver was waiting for him.
Cab driver.
Yes.
He's the hero.
This cab driver was Abed El Hakim Khalil, and he grabbed him by the hair. So Charles told him the police were after him and he wanted help. The cab driver put him in the cab and told him to hide on the floor. He then flagged down a police officer. So this cab driver was a hero.
I mean, he wasn't going to let Charles go. And when Charles tried to manipulate him, he played along with it. And that's how Charles will end up getting caught and arrested. So he doesn't have any ID on him or anything. So when the police arrest him, they just have to go off what he says. And he's going to give him a fake name. He's going to say his name is James McDowell. And they're going to hold him in the parish jail and set bail at $5,250, which he can't afford because he doesn't have any money. So he's going to sit in jail for 6.5 weeks until his trial. And his lawyer thinks he's talking to James, not Charles. The court thinks they're talking to essentially a kind of destitute homeless man who happened to attack a couple people that day. So they're bringing him up on charges of attempted robbery and battery. What happens next, Aaron?
Well, it appears that he wants to get everything off of his chest. And the judge can tell this. So the judge, Judge Richards, says, "Hey, anything you say in this court can be used against you." Charles doesn't seem to care. He announced that he murdered 3 people. He said, "I'm guilty of the charge here today, and not the least of which, 3 murders. My real name is not James McDowell. My real name is Charles Cohen, and I'm one of America's most wanted criminals." And he finished with, I make this confession in Jesus' name.
Apparently, he had found religion in his few weeks in jail.
So the DA, General John Downs from Delaware, traveled to New Orleans to pick Charles up, to bring him back. The Louisiana Deputy Attorney General Stephen Walther asked for permission to question Charles, but he refused. Now, I think Delaware has it right. This is more important that they take care of his charges in Delaware first.
Murder charges will trump, assault and battery charges. Yeah.
Right. So when they got back to Delaware, Charles confessed everything he did. He gave a detailed account, and this confession took place over multiple days. I mean, he spoke from May 26th to the 28th, and police recorded these confessions.
This is commonly referred to as the fried chicken story, because at the time, Charles was willing to talk, and the investigator Downs offered to buy him lunch. And Charles said, "I'll tell you the whole story after I eat my fried chicken." So they sit there and wait patiently while he eats, and they read him his Miranda rights, and they're wondering, is this guy pulling our leg here, or is he actually going to confess? And no, once he's done eating, he talks very candidly about how he murdered his parents. He tells them in great detail about how he lured his father upstairs and then attacked him from behind with a dumbbell, and then called his mother up to check on his father. And that's when he attacked her. And he describes how frail she was and how she couldn't fight back. And once he's done describing murdering his parents, he breaks down and cries. And at this point, Aaron, it's not like he's crying for sympathy. He's not like he's putting on a show. He's truly crying, but I think he's crying at the just audacity of himself, at the monster that he's become.
Yeah, this confession clears some things up for the police. They had thought that he had been set off and then started killing his parents. But he said, "No, I planned it."
He says that he was sober, was not drunk or on any drugs, and it was very much planned. And he says the same thing about when he killed Conrad Lutz. Said he did not drink or do any drugs the night because he was intending on killing this man, and he needed his wits about him. So now, if you don't understand that robbery and stealing probably wasn't the intent or the motive, now you understand that this guy truly was aiming to kill people.
Now, Charles's defense team doesn't want his confessions used against him, and the prosecutors want the death penalty on the table. And they actually had 11 aggravating factors that warranted that. They also had people lined up to testify against Charles. But what do you think the odds are that they can get this stricken so that it can't be used?
I mean, not very good. Regardless of his confession during the interrogation with investigators, there's a courtroom in New Orleans that has his confession. So it doesn't matter at this point if they get his one confession thrown out. There's so many issues here with what he's done that his defense team doesn't have anything really to work with.
Well, it's in November of 1991 when Charles Mark Cohen changed his plea from not guilty to guilty but mentally ill. And the judge ordered him to take antipsychotic medication. So his mental illness becomes a topic at his trial, and two psychiatrists and a psychologist testify about his mental health. Now, they all agreed that Charles had schizophrenia and depression.
But they talk about paranoid schizophrenia, and I guess you can relate that back to his lyrics that he wrote for his stupid band of a man following him around with a gun. But I'm not really sure how that translates into planning on and murdering your parents, and then furthermore, planning on and murdering a man who has taken you into his home. It's not like he was thinking somebody was against him and that's why he murdered them. He claims he was doing this because he was bored. He was felt oppressed by his parents. Like, he has a whole litany of excuses, none of which are, I thought my parents were coming after me. So regardless of his mental state, it doesn't really fit the narrative of his actions.
But by pleading guilty but mentally ill, he's basically saying that he didn't have the willpower to refrain from doing these things because he had a disorder. And the court accepts it on March 19th, 1992. So they move on to the sentencing phase. And this all starts with the recording of his confession. And he had an ex-girlfriend who testified against him. She talked about a letter that he had written to her saying he was going on a rampage of real destruction. He also wrote, "I'd love to rape and kill. I would love to keep people at gunpoint or slit somebody's throat." So she apparently received a number of letters from Charles, and they were all disturbing. He even told her he wanted to rape her.
So this isn't going to go in his favor, but at the same time, it's a death penalty case, and a lot of jurors, they don't want that on their head. They don't want to know that they're putting someone to death, and they're going to consider all mitigating factors, such as his mental health.
The jury recommended 8-4 that he should not get the death penalty. So he received 2 life terms plus 60 years from the judge.
And that's just for his parents' murder. This has nothing to do with Conrad Lutz in California.
Yeah, and that's a case that no one knew who the perpetrator was until his confession. If he hadn't said anything, he wouldn't have had to go through all this trial and everything.
I mean, really, Aaron, if he would have just stuck to his fake name in New Orleans and pleaded guilty to the assault and battery charge and the robbery charge, he might have gotten away with murder completely and sat in a jail in New Orleans, because who knows if they would have been able to get his fingerprints into a national database and find that he was Charles Mark Cohen. You would think that it would be simple. You would think that that would happen, but we've seen how this works. And, you know, this was the late 80s and early 90s. I don't know how much the national database was going on back then, and if they would have been able to tie him back and his identity back.
Well, he definitely had forensic evidence.
But if he hadn't have stepped up and literally confessed who he was and what he did in court in New Orleans, I think he might have just been charged there and spent time behind bars for robbery and battery.
His attorneys in July 1992 wanted him moved to the Delaware State Hospital to receive treatment, but that request was denied by the court. And later that year, Charles waived his claims to his parents' estate. This totaled $330,000. Then he was off to face charges in California and was transferred there for trial.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
There's a book on this case. If you're interested in reading it, it's by Mike Walsh. It's titled The Fallen Son. This is considered to be, I guess you could say, the best source of information about Charles Mark Cohen and his crimes and his life. One of the things that he strove to discover with his book was he wanted to know why Charles killed his parents. And according to Mike Walsh, he said, "Here was a kid who seemed part of the perfect American family. He had a lot of advantages in life and threw them away." And I think that's natural, Justin. I mean, we've brought this up before in different cases. Like, why would so-and-so do this if this other really cool thing was going to happen, or their life seemed really great? But, you know, that's just it. You can say from the outside, it looks great. But, you know, for people who are actually in the situation, whether it's mental health issues or whatever else it might be, there are reasons why people don't think they have a great life. Even if you asked everyone that knew them, you know, they told you, no, it was a great life. That doesn't matter. All that matters is what the person in the situation feels.
He had very loving parents, and he, by all accounts, had a life that most people would love or dream of. But in his mind, his parents' love and support had strings attached. In his mind, he felt like he couldn't do or be himself living under their roof, yet he wasn't very competent. He wasn't competent enough to go out from underneath their umbrella, their support. So according to him, he kind of plays it off like he felt stuck under his parents.
In April of 1994, Charles Mark Cohen pled guilty to murdering Conrad Lutz, and he received a sentence of life in prison without parole. Now, an interesting thing happened. In November of 1994, several inmates at the Gander Hill prison where Charles was staying at escaped. And Charles knew their plans and could have left with them, but chose not to leave.
Which, you know, he says he's found God. He says he confessed in the name of Jesus. And he's trying to, I guess, make amends. He's trying to do the right thing. And he had an opportunity to escape, and he didn't take it. Doesn't mean he's a good person. Doesn't mean that I think he's rehabilitated. But at least he's trying, I guess.
Now, he attempted to have his sentence commuted in August of 2006. Charles went before the State Board of Pardons and explained how finding God, finding Jesus, changed him for the better. He said he wanted to become a Christian minister and preach to others and help them. He said, "I've made a full turnaround. I'm not the same person I was." But as part of this hearing, he had to explain a recent transfer that he had back to the Delaware Psychiatric Center. And his reasoning for it was because someone had placed a witchcraft spell on him. I think this is where the board exchanged glances and within 3 minutes denied his request.
I mean, let's say he got his request in this fantastical world. Well, then he would have to be transferred to California and serve a life sentence there. Personally, I think I would rather stay in the Northeast and the prisons there than a California prison myself. But I don't know what his thought was here, because he wasn't going to be let out free. He was just going to have to go serve another sentence somewhere else.
This was one of, if not the biggest crime stories in Delaware's history. There were, of course, many journalists, many reporters that wanted to talk with Charles Mark Cohen and see if they could get some answers out of him, get him to tell his story. But he just didn't really feel like talking about it. He responded to the Delaware Online's request for an interview by writing back, "I don't want to be interviewed. Sincerely, Charles Cohen." And I kind of want to think that this is because he is still trying to do the right thing, that he doesn't want to talk about these crimes because they're horrible. He's trying to put them behind him and be a different person rather than think about them all the time. And maybe, you know, I don't know if it's like an alcoholic who knows not to take a drink. Maybe he knows not to talk about this anymore. He needs to put it behind him and not focus on it because maybe he'll have that feeling again. Never miss an episode of Generation Y. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Our TikTok is at Gen Y Pod. Our Instagram is at Generation Y Podcast. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.